Hi, it's Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Vanity Fair Chief Critic Richard Lawson. On this season of Still Watching, we'll be covering House of the Dragon, a new HBO series that's a prequel to maybe the biggest HBO show of all time, Game of Thrones. House of the Dragon premieres on Sunday, August 21st, and we'll have a recap episode the next day and every Monday after that until the series finale on October 24th, or season finale, one would hope anyway. But before all that, we wanted to do a little preview just to set the table for what's to come. It's been a while since we wandered the world of Westeros and beyond, and I don't know about you, but I'm feeling a little rusty. House of the Dragon promises to be full of lore and intrigue, much more than one person can unpack on their own. To that end, I've enlisted a co-host, one who is both a podcast extraordinaire and a Game of Thrones expert, I'm told. And that's Josh Wigler. Hello, Josh.
Hello, Richard. I told you that you were supposed to take care of your Valyrian sword so it does not get rusty.
Oh, shoot.
There's a very serious process involved in making sure the rust doesn't gather.
I only got to like page 5 of the manual.
Of the manual?
I guess. Yeah.
It's in the books. It's actually in book 6, which is still yet to be published. So,
okay.
You can be forgiven.
I'll have to go to New Mexico and rifle through George R. R. Martin's desk.
Yes, yes. No, I'm really, really excited to be here. Thank you, Richard, for the kind introduction. Game of Thrones expert, I suppose we will see. Game of Thrones veteran, for sure. I have been covering Game of Thrones since the inception of this show. First back at MTV News way back in the day when season 1 was first coming out. In the last several years, for the final few seasons of Game of Thrones, I was covering the show for The Hollywood Reporter. I also podcast about it a ton, still do, over at Post Show Recaps, my podcast network. So I have a long track record of living in this world, talking about this world. Expertise. I leave that to George R. R. Martin himself, but a fascinated party who has commentated on it a bunch and has read a ton about it as well. I certainly think that fits the bill. So I'm really excited to dive back into it. I know that there are a lot of questions about, is anyone excited about this? Who's excited about this? I'll tell you why I'm excited about it. I'm really, really excited about it. And so I'm beyond thrilled to be joining the Vanity Fair team and still watching and getting to do this with you, Richard. is a real pleasure for me.
Yeah, we're happy to have you. But I want to remind the listeners that this is not just a two-person conversation. We want to hear from you, comments, questions, theories, corrections even. I'm sure there will be those to be given as the season goes on. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We will try to read those in as timely a fashion as possible and then, perhaps answer or address things.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
On the air. All right, so Josh, to kick things off, I'm going to ask you what I hope is a simple, maybe one-sentence answer question. What is House of the Dragon about?
Dragons.
Okay.
How about a one-word answer?
There you go.
I mean, so I think there are some reductive ways to describe House of the Dragon that could kind of shorthand this thing. I think you could describe House of the Dragon as Game of Thrones meets Succession. I think you could describe House of the Dragon as Game of Thrones meets The Crown. I think that this is a show that hopefully those comparisons evoke the idea that House of the Dragon is in many ways, I think, going to be leaning in on some of the best stuff from Game of Thrones, which is the King's Landing of it all. You know, the wheeling and dealing, the politicking, the jockeying for the Iron Throne. That's really the business on this new show that is set several years before the start of Game of Thrones, about two centuries roughly before Game of Thrones. So it's a prequel, the Iron Throne back in play. Someone is sitting in it right now when we begin House of the Dragon. If future is prologue, Richard, I think it's not unreasonable to suggest that maybe some other people will be sitting on the Iron Throne at different points in this show. And that is essentially, you know, the very sort of like top down look at what you can expect. You know, it's going to have the world of Game of Thrones. It's going to have names that are familiar to you if you were a Game of Thrones fan, certainly in terms of the various houses. You'll hear of a Lannister. You'll spot a Stark here and there. But by and large, it's the Targaryen show, where Game of Thrones had the one Targaryen and then a couple of others here and there, and where it only had the three dragons. This is the show with a veritable small army of Targaryens. It's actually not that small. It's a pretty significant army and a pretty significant number of dragons as well.
Yeah, I mean, based on the couple trailers that have been released, they make it clear that this is a pretty King's Landing focused show. But it's not just the trailers, because this is based on a book. You know, while everyone is clamoring for George R. R. Martin to finish the original Song of Ice and Fire books, he in 2018 he published Fire and Blood. So my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that at least this season is a pretty direct adaptation of that book. Is that correct?
So it's like partly correct. Okay. So it's complicated when it comes to George R. R. Martin and books. It's always complicated. That's the relationship status right now. So it is taking its cues from Fire and Blood. This is this fictional history book that George R. R. Martin wrote. It is presented from the perspective of a maester of Old Town within Westeros, chronicling the history of the Targaryen dynasty and leaning on the sources that are available to him in that capacity to tell this story. So from the jump, it's a story from an unreliable narrator. It is told from the perspective of somebody who was not there during the specific events of the initial arrival of the Targaryens to Westeros, all the way through to the appointment of Robert Baratheon as the king, where we kick things off on Game of Thrones. So Fire and Blood begins with the first Targaryen king. It spends many hundreds of pages dealing with him, his two successors to the Iron Throne shortly after his reign. That's a pretty bloody and violent tale. After those three kings are off the map, there is a wise old king named Jaehaerys Targaryen, who reigns over Westeros for a period of relative peace and prosperity for somewhere north of 50 years. And by the end of it, while the Seven Kingdoms have thrived and while there's been a lot of great changes to infrastructure and, all of the creature comforts that these people in Westeros know, such as they know creature comforts, are largely thanks to the initial work by this specific king. He has a lot of personal tragedy. He has a lot of really unfortunate things befall him and his family, and it leaves him in a position where there isn't a very clear heir to the Iron Throne. So I think this will either be at the very start of the show, or this will be the like immediate background material that's worth having the context on heading into House of the Dragon, is that there's this big, think Survivor, tribal council, essentially, to decide who is going to be the winner of the Iron Throne. There's a couple of candidates, the Lords of Westeros vote, and overwhelmingly, Paddy Considine's character, Viserys Targaryen, who is going to be the king when we hit House of the Dragon, is appointed the heir to the Iron Throne. And spinning out from that is where we go with House of the Dragon. That, in the book, Fire and Blood, happens right around like 400 or so pages in. So if you crack open into Fire and Blood and you're reading Aegon's Conquest and you're like, oh man, Oris Baratheon's going to be really fun to see on TV, he's not going to be there, unfortunately. You have to read until about halfway through the book to start interacting with the characters that are going to be on this show.
I see. And that way, HBO's setting, they could do a prequel to the prequel of the
They really could. I mean, yeah. I think that there has been some talk in, you know, the people involved with the show right now, they're clearly making the rounds. They're gearing up. The press machine is in full swing. Ryan J. Condal and Miguel Sapochnik, who are the showrunners of House of the Dragon, are out here saying that, yeah, this could get anthological at a certain point, that the story that's being told now does not have to be the only story of House of the Dragon. So it could move forwards. It could move backwards. That's in success. And success with this show is obviously a very big question in its own right.
I want to zoom out a little bit and think about, you know, potential audience for this show. Obviously, Game of Thrones, a huge international sensation, lots of fans, maybe lost some by the end. But a show that I think did an interesting trick of both rewarding those who knew the lore, who'd read the books, and the casual viewer who is just in it for, you know, pithy lines from Diana Rigg or, you know, a couple sword fights here and there.
Right.
This show, House of the Dragon, in its shrinking down into a King's Landing dynastic struggle versus Game of Thrones, which had people far flung in the east and the north and all over the place, all kind of coming together around one central, almost apocalyptic storyline with, you know, the White Walkers and everything. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on whether you think House of the Dragon benefits from that smallness in attracting audiences who are not that familiar with lore, or do you think this is really a kind of diehard fan show?
I'm very interested in that question myself, because having read the story that this is based on, and just to quickly go back to that, while the story that's being adapted for this show takes place hundreds of pages into Fire and Blood, the book, the scope of what this show seems to be angling at is fully told within Fire and Blood. So the characters that we're going to meet on Sunday night, on August 21st, we are going to know, if you've read the books, how stories end for just about everybody that you see. So unlike Game of Thrones, there is the complete story. There is the complete text that exists underneath that. I just want to put that out there because that might be very good news for a lot of the people who felt like the show ran off the rails once there was no more runway provided by George R. R. Martin's source material on Game of Thrones. This has the runway. This has a complete shape of a story. We know where it's going if you've read Fire and Blood. That being said, I'm really curious about your question as well, Richard, about whether or not this is sort of a niche story, you know, maybe a little bit too granular for the average Game of Thrones fan. And I think it's going to be a little hard to say until we see how they render that first episode. With that being said, I know that I'm talking about King's Landing political intrigue being sort of the bread and butter of this show. And I do think that in a major way, this is going to be the thing. You know, the quest for the Iron Throne, once again, you can already see the promotional materials of them putting, in your head anyway, of putting so many different people on the Iron Throne. Like, this will be the thing that is in pursuit throughout this series, the thing that is being defended, the thing that is being coveted. But there are also so many dragons. It is just worth repeating, there are so many dragons. And I don't know the extent to which those dragons will start barking here in season one, but if this show is sticking to the script of the book as written, there will be barking at some point in time. So I think that a lot of the action intrigue of the show as well, of Game of Thrones, is very much in full swing here. And I think maybe the thing that it benefits from the most is this sort of centering on King's Landing. If we're looking at the geography of Westeros, I don't know how long it's been since any of you out there have been looking at the map, but King's Landing, it's further south than the north. It is further south than Winterfell and the Wall, and therefore the White Walkers, which I know is a really divisive part of how Game of Thrones ended. They should have little to do here on House of the Dragon. There's a chance that there's a mention of a White Walker or two. They'll be, you know, surprising me quite a bit if there's much more than that, than a mention or two of the White Walkers. But the thing that was really controversial, I feel like, towards the end of Game of Thrones, like the swift dealing with this existential threat, that's not really here. So I think that the stakes are pretty clear on this show, and the scope is also, I think, standing to be pretty impressive as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, Game of Thrones, especially in the early seasons, what was so captivating, well, in the books as well, obviously, is that sense of important, something is coming, you know, winter's coming, these people, these entities from the north are coming in, and it, there was a sort of mythos, a sort of supernatural element. This seems House of the Dragon much more rooted in like human conflict. Not that Game of Thrones wasn't. So I'll be curious to see how the people who liked Game of Thrones for all of the supernatural stuff will be satisfied by this. Or, you know, I mean, I should mention, you talked about the dragons. I'm told in press notes that I've read that there are four main dragons. One is a kind of sassy New York newspaper columnist. The other's a lawyer, a gallery owner, and a publicist, right? And they're kind of friends. And
And I don't want to spoil it, but one of them ends up working for a sprinkler company in Florida by the end of the show. So it's a pretty tragic fall for that one.
So let's talk specifics about who this show is about. You mentioned Paddy Considine, who plays King Viserys, who at the start of this season, which, by the way, you and I have not watched, we should tell the viewer, we are getting screeners at some point, but we are as blunt, you know, pretty much in the dark as you all are.
It's exciting buzz, I'll say. You know, a lot of people who have seen, who are at premieres, who have reported back. I'm trying not to get overly optimistic, Richard. It's getting a little hard for me, though. People seem to really enjoy that first episode,
but it's good. It's good to be excited. So we have him on the throne. There is a question of succession. Who's going to take over? One obvious answer would be Princess Rhaenyra, who is his daughter, played by Emma Darcy. She's maybe what, tween age, early teens.
So it's interesting. Rhaenyra Targaryen, and this is why I evoke the crown in some ways, at least, not just because Matt Smith is also on this show, that we are going to be seeing different actors portraying certain characters across periods of time. Princess Rhaenyra is one of those. So when we meet Princess Rhaenyra, and I believe that this is being told in chronological order without flashbacks, could be wrong on that. We'll see how it bears out. Initially, Rhaenyra is going to be played by Millie Alcock is the name of the young actor who's going to be bringing her to life. And I don't think that that's just for a scene. I think that's going to be for, you know, several chunks of story. You know, we could be several episodes in before we get Emma Darcy, who they are going to be playing Rhaenyra as an adult. But yes, this is Princess Rhaenyra. This is Viserys's daughter. This is one of, you know, the real jewels in the eye of King Viserys. A very beloved princess in the Seven Kingdoms. People really are huge fans of Rhaenyra. And I think if you're looking for your Daenerys analog, I think that this is probably the one.
Right. I now am wondering if, not knowing the structure of the show, if we might get older Rhaenyra scenes and younger, you know, kind of like two timelines. I kind of hope that's not what they're doing, but
yeah, you'll have to go to Reddit to see if you can't piece together which one is the crown in black. Yeah. Right.
So you mentioned Matt Smith, beloved of, you know, genre nerds the world over. He was a Doctor Who, right? Yeah,
he was. Wait, when you say it like that he was a Doctor Who, is this a confession that you're not a Doctor Who person?
So my boyfriend got me into Doctor Who during the deepest depths of the pandemic, and I watched the couple of the early seasons with Eccleston. But I didn't make it to Matt Smith. But I know Matt Smith was just famous, you know, about 15 years ago. And I was like, from what? And then I've subsequently seen him in a lot of things, including Morbius, which I thought he was very good in. And
he was
one of the few
the
positive
part.
Reviews of that movie.
I mean, no one was having more fun in Morbius than Matt Smith, other than maybe the people who forced Sony to put it in theaters twice. Matt Smith, I'm also not a major Doctor Who person. I just started watching some of it because I wanted to, you know, get a little bit more acquainted with Matt Smith's most famous role. And so I just watched The 11th Hour, his first episode, and God, I really loved it. So I'm going to have to find some time to manage my Doctor Who watch while we have House of the Dragon online. So wish me luck in that endeavor. But yeah, he is playing, I think, a character who is going to be a huge breakout from this show. Matt Smith is playing Prince Daemon Targaryen, and he is, as we enter this, the heir presumptive to the Iron Throne. At this point, he is the next in line of succession. Viserys Targaryen, his brother, does not have a male heir, and so as it stands, Daemon would be the person who would step up to become king, and that, from the perspective of certain parties in Westeros, could be quite bad. It would be bad. He is sort of a... You know, he's a bit of a rogue. He is known as the Rogue Prince. And I feel like calling him a bit of a rogue is really nicening up the behavior of this guy. He can be very violent. He can be very hedonistic. And he is not always the nicest guy in the room, and yet very, very captivating. So I think probably the closest comparison is a Jaime Lannister type, with maybe even a little bit of a rougher edge to him.
Or a Cersei in there, too, a kind of villain we root for in a perverse way. Kind of thing.
He's the Lannister twins combined.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder what they were doing 200 years prior vis-a-vis shame nuns, you know, like maybe they use a different word, a different a cowbell more rather than a, I don't know.
Yeah, I think if you're bringing anyone from Game of Thrones back to House of the Dragon, I would be totally fine to just see Hannah Waddingham just travel back through time to shame someone. Yeah, would be fine. Yeah.
You know, why not? A long tradition of shaming in Westeros. A character that, and I'm just, I'll be honest, looking at the Wikipedia page, that I'm really curious about because I like this actor, Olivia Cooke. She's playing Alicent Hightower, who is the first person we've talked about who is not part of this family. So I think that's where the, you know, we are in a sort of cloistered courtly world here, but it can widen out to include non-Targaryen people. And I'm really curious to see how the people who are, you know, trying to jockey for power, Littlefinger style. They know they're not going to actually be on the throne probably ever, but like they want to be as adjacent to it as possible. So I'm very intrigued about Alicent Hightower.
Yeah, so there is, you know, it's the Targaryen show. It is the House of the Dragon, but it is not just the Targaryens. And there definitely are characters from other houses, certainly houses that you know. There's going to be, you know, one or two at least Lannisters, including yet another set of Lannister twins, believe it or not, that are going to be important to this story as we are moving forward. We are going to be focusing, I think, more on houses that we are not as familiar with. Certainly the Targaryens, we are familiar with their reputation, but let's see what that looks like in practice. These dragon riding people who, when you flip a coin, either they're cool or they're severely uncool. So we're going to see how that plays out. The Hightowers are another important family in this story. So Olivia Cooke, who is playing Alicent Hightower, as a young person, she will be played by Emily Carey. So yet another indication of sort of the generational story that's being told here. She is the daughter of Otto Hightower, who is played by Rhys Ifans, you know, most recent of the Spider-Man No Way Home blockbuster, but forever the kicker in The Replacements in my heart. And he is ostensibly the hand of the king. He is going to be Viserys Targaryen's right-hand person. And if anyone in this show hates Daemon Targaryen, no one hates him more, I think, than Sir Otto Hightower. So expect a lot of fireworks between Matt Smith and Rhys Ifans' characters. I think that that's going to be a really contentious relationship to watch. Alicent's role within all of that, I feel like I have to be a little careful here, Richard. I feel like I have to be a little careful here because we don't know the way that the show is going to bear out. And I don't know when you want to start like drawing from, you know, the specifics of the books, if ever. But I definitely feel like when we get to those points, if we want to go down those conversational alleyways, I will feel most comfortable giving a fairly significant spoiler warning on that stuff. That's one of the tricks of this story, I think, is with the later seasons of Game of Thrones, we could make reasonable predictions based on things that hadn't been put on the show, but were still, you know, remnants of A Dance with Dragons, the fifth book, chapters that we knew from the sixth book that still remains unpublished, but those excerpts have been released. And just like reasonable predictions, I think, of some fan theories, like the R plus L equals J was a foregone conclusion that Jon Snow was a Targaryen. Here, the theorizing is a little trickier because the story is complete. So we do know where a lot of these characters are going. We do know how this ends for a bunch of them. And I think that Alicent, specifically her journey and what it is that she brings to this particular tale and this story of succession and this story of the Targaryens sort of feeling each other out and peacocking about King's Landing and one-upping each other to see who can land in the highest spot. She has a really, really big role in that.
So before we wrap up, you mentioned the later seasons of Game of Thrones, which, you know, as has been alluded to already on this episode, was where things maybe got a bit rickety for fans, not only just of the books, but like people who would just watch the show and didn't know anything about the text that they were based on. Even they were like, things seem to be a little bit less tight here. And then the series finale happened. A lot of people called it like they ruined this brand. It's the worst series finale ever. You know, there were a lot of feelings about it. I'm sure some people love it as well.
As a Lost fan, I was thrilled to have the heat taken off of my there favorite show. Exactly. I have to tell you that.
Same. Very much same. Yeah. So where do you think, Josh, like from a sort of programming perspective, what does this show need to be for HBO to like rescue the brand if it indeed is that tarnished. Like, because I think, well, there seems to be a weird mix of both really high expectations for this and people who are like, oh, no, I'm not going back to that. I'm not going to be disappointed. So talk to me a little bit about what you think the needle that they have to thread here is.
It's a tight eye of the needle. The eye is closing and they really have to get through. I am interested in who is coming back for this. The people on the streets, the people who I'm surveying, many of whom are, book reading fans of Game of Thrones, some who were just Game of Thrones diehards, some who were Game of Thrones casuals. I think actually it's a lot of the casual Game of Thrones fans that I'm talking to who felt like they got burned and don't really want to check this out. A lot of the people I am talking to, there's a small contingent of people who I think are really, without any reservation, super excited about this. The majority of people I know who are, people who would be watching this show under normal circumstances are ready to give it an episode. They want to give it a shot. They want to see how the episode does. So I think a lot qualitatively is riding on this premiere. They really have to put their best foot forward here, HBO does, because in success, House of the Dragon leads to other Game of Thrones successor shows for HBO. And it's something that they probably really, really need. Game of Thrones was, to your point earlier at the start of the pod, their biggest show ever. And it ended the way that it did. And it ended in a way where, it's very easy to dunk on it and to egg it. And so it's a tricky thing. That the reputation is what it is, but the accolades are what they are as well behind Game of Thrones. And I think that it has to perform at a level that it's not going to hit the viewership highs of Game of Thrones right off the bat. I think HBO's very own Casey Bloys has been pretty clear about the expectations are a little different. The numbers that they're looking at are adjusted, and that they also have their hand hovering over the green light button for a second season. It has not yet been greenlit for a second season. I feel like they are ready to turn the key when they see the metrics that they need to see. It's an interesting time for HBO and Warner Media and HBO Max. And so I think that certain people, in certain times, maybe, even a few months ago, Richard, a second season of House of the Dragon would be like an automatic thing, I would think, almost, irregardless of how this ends up, performing metrically. I think that with some of the new people sitting on the proverbial Iron Throne, this has to do pretty well because the game plan is, in success of this, more shows. Not just House of the Dragon. It's that strange Jon Snow sequel we've heard about. There is a planned or developing at least prequel centering on one of the characters from this show, from House of the Dragon. And that's the direction that I think they want to take it. We will know whether or not it is a reasonable bet to take on another Game of Thrones franchise show after we see how this one is performing.
Yeah, and speaking of time and this legacy, I think an interesting thing to think about as we go forward, kind of analyzing the show week to week, is that Game of Thrones, if you can believe it, premiered, the original series premiered over 11 years ago. And in that time, we have seen... We were all kind of in the midst of it then, but it's even more so now, huge shifts in cultural mores, in ideas about representation and diversity, and what our art is supposed to be doing or not supposed to be doing. And I'll be curious to see what a 2022, or I guess filmed in 2021, whatever, version of this violent, misogynistic, et cetera, world looks like once it's filtered through some of that. I mean, already from the trailer, it looks like we're getting a more diverse cast than we certainly had in Game of Thrones. But I don't know beyond that. I've heard whispers on the wind that this is a very violent show. And I'm curious how that violence will be processed. So I don't know. I think the world was in a very different place, obviously, when the original show premiered, and we'll see how a return to Westeros is greeted. By the people of 2022.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, and I think it's really important to bring up. So I'm very compelled by the story that is told in the book that this show is taking most of its cues from. I'm also really excited about the people who are running this thing. Mm-hmm. Miguel Sapochnik, who directed some of the greatest episodes of Game of Thrones, certainly in that back half of Game of Thrones. Battle of the Bastards, The Winds of Winter, really phenomenal filmmaker. And as one of the showrunners here, I really trust the vision of this, literally what it's going to look like. I think it's going to be really impressive. I also really am a big fan of Ryan Condal, who is the other showrunner on this, co-created it with George R. R. Martin, handpicked by Martin. They had a friendship that predated this. Martin, the story goes, came to Ryan Condal during a dinner meeting. This was in the Big Hollywood Reporter profile on House of the Dragon. And the next day, Ryan Condal had a phone call from his agent saying, hey, are you showrunning House of the Dragon? So a big leap of faith, or a vote of confidence, at least, from George R. R. Martin. And I will take every opportunity that I possibly can to say that Ryan Condal's Colony, the USA Network show that none of you watched, was really terrific and fantastic. And I think the sensibilities of that show, for me, give me a sense of how he operates as a storyteller. So I really love the way that he operates as a storyteller. But those are just two names of many. I think in certainly the later stages of Game of Thrones, one of the criticisms that you can lob at it is how much of a monopoly David Benioff and D.B. Weiss had on the scene. They were, with some exceptions, they were the writers. They took on a lot of directing towards the end. They were on set. They were living and breathing this thing in a way that I still felt like, I felt like at the time and still feel like, obviously really would have benefited from a lot of outside voices, and certainly a lot of voices that were not like their own. This is a more diverse lineup, both in front of and behind the camera. There are a lot of women who are on the writing staff. It is not just, white dude central here on House of the Dragon. And I think that's really important to get into a story that's going to, if it's done well and if it's done right, it's going to have to deal with, systemic oppression from the patriarchy. That is a very big theme in the story of House of the Dragon. And I think that they've got a team assembled that feels to me, just, going through the credits of the people who are involved, I think that they're up for the challenge. And I think it's really nice to see a lot of this represented on screen as well. Emma D'Arcy as a non-binary person playing Rhaenyra Targaryen, that's very exciting to me. Steve Toussaint, whose name I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, he is the Sea Snake, the first Black actor in a lead role in a Game of Thrones show. The Sea Snake is the character, the aforementioned character, that they are thinking about some form of prequel around. Ooh. So he's exciting. He's really cool. And I think that they're going to have a lot of fun with that character. So I think it, in meaningful ways, the beats of House of the Dragon and the story that it is adapting have a lot of similarities to the beats and the story that was being told of Game of Thrones. There will be a little bit of a sense of that Battlestar Galactica thing of all of this has happened before, all of this has happened again. But I feel like it will feel different in some really important ways that I'm excited for. As to the violence, there's just no sugarcoating it, Richard. This is going to be violent. Yeah. It's going to be dark. Yeah. It's going to be depressing. Yeah. Be prepared to say goodbye to your favorites with regularity. There are some events in this period of time that make the Red Wedding look like a tea party. So it's going to get really intense. And with all that we have gone through, with all that we are going through, whether or not you want to put yourself through that in your form of escapist pop culture media, totally your call to make. But you should make that call knowing these things are very much in play. A lot of the things that often made Game of Thrones hard to watch, very much alive and well in House of the Dragon, I think, no matter what.
I don't know what it says about me, but that kind of makes me more grimly excited. I don't know. But all right. Well,
because it'll have something to say, right?
You right. Know? Exactly.
Yeah, that's good.
So, yeah, we'll be back on August 22nd with a recap episode of the first the premiere episode. Before we go, let's do a little predicting. Josh, how many minutes into the first episode do you think we're going to see a dragon?
Oh, gosh. If we don't see a dragon in the first 5 minutes, I will be angry and I will shut off the TV and I will walk away from this podcast prematurely. No, we'll get a dragon within, I think, 10 minutes. 10 okay. minutes. 10 minutes tops is my take.
I'm going to say first 30 seconds. It opens. We hear the sound of the wings flapping and then one flies by and we're in it.
I'm ready for that. I think okay. that's the way this has to go. And I actually really love that juxtaposition of the first scene of Game of Thrones ever is very White Walker heavy. That's the ice. Let's begin this one with some fire.
There you go. Well, in the meantime, if you have any predictive questions or concerns or anything like that, again, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. You can read about House of the Dragon on VF.com, including Josh's recaps. And some other coverage as the season goes on. And then, Josh, where can people find you online separate of all this?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter, at Round Howard is my Twitter handle. I have often said like Ron Howard, but rounder. I have since retired that way of describing my Twitter handle, but for the still watching crowd, as I am saying hello for the first time, I feel like it's easier to remember it that way. So at Round Howard, wherever you can find me, I will be tweeting out my recaps of House of the Dragon here on VF, any other breakouts along the way. I will be I'll be sounding the horn. It'll be hard to miss if you're following me there.
Okay, good. And I will be at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S. This episode was edited and produced by Dave Gonzalez. And until next week, I don't know, happy dragon hunting.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.